Ahoy, mateys. Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. This week, we're bringing you episode 18, The Changing Role of Challenge in Games. We're recording January 12th, 2013. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Arr!
This week, as I mentioned, we're going to talk a little bit about difficulty in games. But first, let's hit up those follow-ups. We're going to start off here today with a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. You know, I've been talking a lot about this over the last few months. But the creditors in THQ's bankruptcy have objected to the sale conditions that were previously set. We talked a little bit about that, I think, sort of discussing how the Clear Lake Capital Group had insisted that all of the studios and all of the IPs all sort of stay formed, and they basically wanted to sell THQ whole and keep it in one piece. And basically, several different parties, including a trustee from the U.S., filed an objection over, first off, the timetable to the sale and to those conditions of keeping it sort of whole. So now we're sort of entering the process where in the next couple of weeks, any and all comers that have money will be able to bid for any individual part of THQ's sort of entity.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate that it played out that way. I mean, I guess for people who are more concerned about the franchises themselves than the actual employees, you know, it's like we aren't going to have to worry about Saints Row. That's going to find a home, obviously. Probably even things like Darksiders, which didn't sell as well, you know. I'm sure that they will be snatched up.
And to be fair, you know, Saints Row, we look at it. Not Saints Row, I'm sorry. Darksiders. We look at it as, oh, it didn't do so well, but it still moved, you know, several million units. Even Darksiders 2.
Well, yeah, but something ridiculous standards for blockbusters in games these days.
So. Oh, yeah, no, I just mean that if someone else can snap that property up, that IP, that if they can figure out a way to make a Darksiders game on the cheap while still retaining that level of quality, there's definitely an opportunity for money there.
Oh, for sure.
So, you know, this is not the best case scenario. I would argue it's probably pretty bad. We already know that EA is sniffing in, ready to make a bid.
Oh, of course they are.
Ubisoft has indicated that they'll be making a bid. So I'm sure Saints Row is going to be sort of the big get here, and you know, I just think it's really unfortunate. I hope it ends up somewhere where it's treated right. And, you know, same for Darksiders. I'm a big fan, and it really upsets me to think that, you know, we very well could theoretically see it die here or end up in the hands of someone who just views it as a property and not, you know, sort of a really sort of neat, special little game.
Yeah, so we're just going to have to see how this plays out. You know, we'll have more to tell you once we hear more, pretty much.
Yep, absolutely.
We'd like to give you a follow-up about Star Wars The Old Republic. As we mentioned a while back, it's switched to a freemium model. And actually what we want to talk to you about today is there was another great article on Forbes.com of all places.
Damn, Forbes.
Yeah, way to do it right. In the upcoming expansion, Rise of the Hutt Cartel, they're going to be introducing what they call same-gender romance, which is, you know, same-sex relationships.
Woo. Now, that is awesome, but one thing that I think is really noteworthy here when I was reading this article is that they indicated that these would be like new NPC romances,
right? It's
not
be
romances
on,
with existing companions,
which some people are like about, but you know, I think just good on them for doing it instead of like just trying to force it in and, you know, not do it right to, you know, just introduce it this way. It's going to be on the planet of Makkab. I don't know if that's an actual Star Wars planet that exists in canon.
It must exist in the expanded universe. Everything does.
Which is a planet invaded by the Hutt Cartel. So, you know, NPCs are going to have these same-gender romance options. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think that's great. BioWare has always been really supportive of you know, LGBT issues in gaming. And, I mean, the only thing that I can foresee that, you know, will be unfortunate, but it seems inevitable is, you know, people in game and out of game being like, oh, well, now we have to go to the homo planet.
Homo planet.
And of course,
hey.
Of course, you know, that's not the actual word they would use, but,
yeah.
You might be familiar with the word that we mean to use, being
girl. I don't mean to use it.
No, well, you know what I'm saying. The word that we are substituting for what they would actually say has been very prevalent in the entertainment industry right now.
Yeah, they'll definitely, unfortunately, be referring to it as the unpleasant word planet. It's not very.
Yeah,
it's
so,
not very.
I
good.
Mean, you know, but honestly, that's just why it's important for. There to be gay characters in games so that we can eventually get to a place that this is not even an issue. I mean, there's always going to be haters, but, you know, way to go, BioWare. I mean, of course, this is something that they've been talking about since the game was in development, but it's cool to finally see it happening. So, you know, I'm probably going to load up Old Republic once this expansion hits and get myself a gay romance.
Excellent. Yeah, I think I'll probably do the same thing, honestly, so... you know, good on you, BioWare. You're bringing two of us back.
Right.
Next up on the list, and I'm this is just going to be a real quick one. We had talked previously about Code Hero, the Kickstarter, where the backers all really felt shafted by the way things have sort of gone down. The long story short is that very little has changed, and accordingly, the backers are now looking into legal action.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm really bummed that, you know what, this such a really exciting, cool scene just a few months ago is already turning out to be pretty dire. It really looks like, you know, it's very possible that this guy ripped a lot of people off, and I'm just really hoping it wasn't that he's really just super fail at communicating and that ultimately this is all going to pull together. So
yeah, I mean, I'm kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt here. I can't really speak for anyone who has contributed, like, big amounts of money because I've never pledged, like, in the thousands or anything for Kickstarter. So usually I keep my investment in at the level of, you know, if it doesn't pan out, it's, you know, it's whatever. I try to support something cool. But, you know, hopefully this works out for everyone, both the guy who is running it and the pledgers, you know. But sucks that it's looking like it's not going to end well.
Definitely.
We brought you some footage of Ouya unboxing last time, courtesy of Kotaku. Now, once again on Kotaku, they have footage of an actual game running on the Ouya.
Woo!
It's called Roasty Rooster by a Finnish studio, Aptual. I don't even know if I'm saying that right.
Just go with it.
You know, it just kind of looks basically like an Android casual smartphone game, so... you know, my opinion is I have an Ouya on its way, like it or not. You know, if it ends up flopping, at least it'll be a good emulation box. Now, a little disclaimer, we here at GameBuoy want to support, you know, companies and studios whenever you can. But the fact is that sometimes there are games that just aren't available anymore. So, you know.
I'll tell you this right now. Until Capcom gives you a legal way to purchase Demon's Crest... I wholeheartedly encourage you to download it and play it through whatever means necessary.
Precisely. And speaking of emulation, we're also going to link to you on GameFans.com on our site, GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
They posted some gameplay videos of the Ouya running some emulators, including Super Mario 64, which looks like it runs really well. But of course, we would advise you to, you know, get it on Virtual Console because...
Or even the DS port.
Exactly. You know, but...
That having been said, if you're trying to play something like Mischief Makers, this might be the way.
Yeah. So if we'd like to know, of course, what you think. We'll give you our Twitter and stuff at the end, but if you think that Roasty Rooster actually looks great, then...
Judging you a little bit.
Yeah, let us know, but let us know what you think about the Ouya. We'd be curious to hear.
And last, but certainly not least, possibly for the first time in GameBuoy history... We have a one-sentence follow-up. Final Fantasy XIV beta applications open.
Did you apply for your beta?
I sure did.
And the thing that I realized is that I was talking about this a couple episodes back, that I'm concerned about my laptop not being able to run it. Then I realized, oh yeah, the PS3 version's going to be coming out. So I signed up for PC and PS3 beta. So, you know, hopefully I can maybe get in on that PS3 beta action. It looks great. I mean, everybody who's kind of been talking about it thinks that it looks great. So
I know several people under NDA who can't talk about being a part of the previous beta or alpha or whatever.
Alpha, yeah.
Who have only said they can't wait for everyone to see it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've had faith in Square Enix as they've been trying to, you know, kind of do damage control and clean up the mess, so to speak. But, you know, I'm definitely going to give it a try as long as there's a way for me to, you know, run it in a playable way. Which, if I can get it on PS3, then, hey, I'm down to do that. Hook up a mouse and a keyboard and I'll be all set. Now, I'm assuming it's still going to be cross-platform, like 11.
Yep, that is okay, my understanding.
Great. Sweet.
Awesome. All right.
So that does it for our follow-ups, right?
Yep, takes us to
news. 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 Oh my god, news.
All right, we have quite a few news stories to run for you guys today. So we're going to try to take these a little bit quick, try to keep our show a little shorter this week than we have been for the last month or so. So first up, we have a story here. Terry Cavanaugh, the developer behind VVVVVV and Super Hexagon, has canceled two projects that he's been working on for a few years now, which he has talked to his fan base about already quite a bit. Those would be Nexus City and its spinoff Selma's Story. You might be familiar with these projects if you follow him on his forums. Basically, he's still making games. He just decided he was going to cancel these two, take a little bit of time for himself, and then get back into the thick of it.
Yeah, from my understanding, he was always feeling that like he had to put those as a higher priority, right?
Yeah, that's how I understand the post that he made, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not too familiar with these two games, but, you know, I can understand that. If he's feeling that he's not able to create the things he wants because he feels obligated to work on these other two, then, you know, he's got to do what's best for him, so.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So it sucks, but, you know, good on you for making a good choice for you. And, you know, hopefully you'll come back to these games down the line.
So, Zynga, I never know how to say it, and it doesn't really matter. They're shutting down 11 games. Before you get too excited, these include Mafia Wars 2, Petville, and Indiana Jones Adventure World. However, most of them are from Zynga Japan, which has had its doors closed. That was last month, I think. Yeah, last month. So, unfortunately, you will probably still get bombarded with Cityville and Words with Friends requests if you have friends on Facebook who play those. But, you know, they're trimming down their portfolio a bit.
You know, the weird thing to me is that outside of a small article on Joystick, which is where I'm sourcing this report from, I have not really heard much about this in the news at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if people don't really pick up on the social gaming thing, even though it's pretty huge. And Joystick themselves got it from TechCrunch, so. Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of people talking about this. I think maybe because the audience for these types of games aren't the ones who are really probably following news... gaming journalism. That's just a guess, but probably not following news journalism either, let's be real, because too busy spending $50 on Farmville tokens.
This from the man who used to cut school to play Animal Crossing.
I give no fucks.
Well done. Next up, one that is certainly very exciting for me, is that Capcom is developing a classic games platform for PSN and XBLA called the Capcom Arcade Cabinet. We have very few details at this point. All we really know is that the game that will be included sort of as the starter pack for this platform where you'll download classic games is Black Tiger. It's a side-scrolling action game from 1987 with RPG elements. And those of you who are longtime listeners have probably heard me mention this before because it's probably my favorite arcade game of all time.
Well, I know someone who's going to be all over this Capcom arcade cabinet.
Yeah, right? It sounds great to me, you know. The full reveal, I guess, is going to be taking place February 7th. There was, via 4chan or something, which means I will probably not be linking it on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
There was some Japanese promo art that leaked that indicated quite a few games coming to this thing, including stuff like Commando looked like it was represented, possibly the spin-off / sequel, Mercs, you know, Mercenaries. Very exciting stuff. I can't wait to see what's announced on February 7th for this thing, because I'm always down for publisher-specific retro game platform on Xbox 360.
Yeah, you know, if Capcom's really paying attention to their retro library, maybe Captain Spike will finally get Demon's Crest HD remasters.
Realistically, I'd be happy with just more Ghosts and Goblins.
We'll see. So the next news item, we're not going to spend too much time talking about. It's not really big news. Two games were announced for worldwide simultaneous release. You might have heard of them. They're called Pokemon X and Y. Not really a big deal, though, right?
No, it's not a big deal at all.
It's coming out for 3DS, overhauled graphics engine that makes it look like it's straight out of the anime now. Not really a big deal.
No. In fact, you know, it just looks like a Dragon Quest IX ripoff.
Pretty much. No, we're both super excited. So you probably do know about this already if you're listening.
If you're listening to Game Buoy, chances are you already know what Pokemon X and Y are, and probably you're going to get it already.
This is probably the furthest from what we try to do in our new section, but we couldn't not mention it.
So we're super stoked. Those of you out there who are also stoked, please text us. Please tweet at us at GameBuoy.org. That's DOTORG.
GameBuoy.org. That's DOTORG. They've already revealed the starters. There is Chespin, Fennekin, and Froakie,
who are... I cannot wait for Fennekin.
I'm all about Chespin here. They also revealed the two legendaries, whose names I can't really say. It's like Xerneas and they're something with a Y.
So we'll post them on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And then you can laugh at Slidekick for not knowing how to pronounce them.
Whatever. But as you can tell, we already know what starters we're picking, so yeah, can someone say Obsessed?
Yeah. So you may or may not have heard, there's this annual event happening right now. It's the Consumer Electronics Show.
Oh, it's only been going on for a couple of decades. They probably haven't heard of it.
Yeah. You know, that's CES for short. We want to go down real quick the news lineup for CES.
Or in some cases,
this year.
Lack of news, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that because the first one I was going to talk about here, Sony did not really show anything gaming specific.
Yeah, they showed the Xperia Z, which is a new Xperia phone.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, but there was a big focus on 4K TVs.
Interesting.
So, again,
honestly,
I guess that's going to be a thing.
Yeah. And I believe, was it Samsung who was also showing off their 4K TVs, those ones were like 80 inches or something.
Yeah, I saw a photo of one that was like 105 or something. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd love to have one, but who the hell makes that?
Samsung, apparently.
Okay, well, yeah.
And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Samsung and Sony for the longest time have been kind of the two leaders in HD TVs. I haven't followed TVs before HD, really. But
I think a lot of people would agree with your assessment.
You know, so...
if you don't agree with that assessment, tweet at us at GameBuoy.org.
Yeah, we'd love to hear how you like your Dynex HD TV.
I have a Dynex. Rude.
and it's actually not bad. That said, you know, nothing really about gaming except that this probably does mean that the Orbis or PS4 or whatever it's going to be called is probably going to be pushing for bigger, badder, better. And, you know, I've kind of buried my hatchet with Sony, like I said, but, you know, I don't want them to get so focused on trying to make, you know, realistic, super badass looking games that it's inaccessible to developers. I guess that's where I stand. So,
a reasonable fear, I think.
We'll link you to a live blog, which is not live anymore.
But, aww. You know,
well, I mean, it's live on the site, but it's not being updated live.
No, I follow what you were saying. I was being facetious.
You bitch. From The Verge, who did some good coverage of CES this year. So you can find that on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
I guess we can just move on, right? Because Sony didn't have anything.
Yeah, yeah. And well, Microsoft... you know, strictly speaking, Microsoft didn't exactly either. But they did show off, and, you know, before I call this a proof of concept, which it was, it's important to note that a lot of people are calling this a technology that we're about to see in Nextbox, Durango, Xbox 720, whatever you want to call it. Microsoft showed off this kind of cool tech called Illumiroom, which basically uses a series of projectors hooked up to your console, which is itself hooked up to your Kinect, that scans your room and then projects images onto the room around you to create sort of a visual illusion of sort of the game's environment enveloping you.
Oh, so basically it's the Dreamatorium from Community, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, the easier to go with analog of it being a holodeck.
Right, right.
And, you know, I mean, if this technology works as advertised, it looks kind of neat. I can't help but think it must be super expensive to have that many projectors.
Right.
But it looks, you know, it looks kind of cool, I guess. I would certainly play with one if cost weren't an issue. But again, this is a proof of concept demo.
Yeah, I think the thing to take away from this more so is not that, oh, this is going to be in the 720 Nextbox Durango. But, you know, this is something that they're working on, so we'll see it someday. So
yeah, hopefully. It looks really cool. It looks pretty neat, and I could see a lot of cool applications for it in a game like Capcom's old Steel Battalion, which, if you recall, had its own custom controller that cost several hundred dollars and had, you know, several hundred buttons on it to be laid out like a mecha controller.
That's kind of badass.
It was a really incredible experience. And when I think about the idea of playing a game like that on a next-gen console with, like, my cockpit being projected into the room around me, like, yeah, okay, that sounds bad as fuck.
Yeah.
I don't think that the tech is there yet, but I hope Microsoft sticks with it and gets it there.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that the direction Microsoft is heading in, gaming... wise, not with their operating system.
LOL.
But, you know, the way that they seem to be heading with the Xbox, not just as a gaming platform, but as a whole entertainment platform, I think that they're going in the right direction, personally.
Yeah.
So I would love to have an Illumiroom one day and, you know, just maybe have a Choaniki game. No, I'm kidding. But
there's just protein floating everywhere.
Ugh, my dream.
Anyway, that's enough of that. Next up, we have official confirmation and have been now shown units on which Valve is working with third-party hardware developers to create, you know, basically Steam-approved little box set-top boxes for, you know, little PCs for gaming and doing Steam on your TV and stuff.
Yeah. I think it's important to note that this is not the Steam box specifically. That is going to still be a thing, though. We have some good articles from Polygon and also The Verge, which is there. I believe that they are still kind of family, because Polygon got its start on The Verge.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a great article, interview, rather, on The Verge with Gabe Newell, And I thought it was really pretty great. You know, it was interesting because, you know, it kind of goes into, like, where he thinks gaming is going. And, you know, he gets a lot of flack on the internet.
Unfortunately, half of the flack he gets on the internet is just about his body.
That's so shameful. But, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, worked on Microsoft Windows back when it wasn't a terrible touchscreen emphasized, basically Xbox Live. I haven't even worked with Windows 8, and
it's awful. I've used it on a touchscreen tablet, and it was actually pretty nice. But on a PC, it's dreadful.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of which, Gabe Newell thinks it's terrible. So totally, it's still somewhat relevant. But
anyway.
Basically, if you're interested in more about the Steam Box and Steam's partnership with third parties, we encourage you to look at Polygon because they have something called a story stream at the bottom of these articles. It's basically just showing the development of the story, but I think it's really laid out in a nice way to see how it developed. So, you know, if you want to kind of look into Steam's first foray into the hardware business, go check that out on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And up next is the most surprising, at least to me, announcement gaming-wise at CES. NVIDIA, who of course we know for graphics cards, they are making a portable gaming console. But the thing is, the reason that I had to hesitate is that it seems like it's going to do a lot of things at once. It's called the Shield, Project Shield. That's a code name right now, but...
yeah, apparently its in-development name was Thor.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah,
somebody at NVIDIA is clearly an Avengers fan.
Who isn't at this point?
Yeah, really. It's basically a Xbox 360 controller-sized controller with a 720p screen attached to it. It has a Tegra 4 chip inside. It's a pretty powerful. It's an Android based portable gaming console, but you know, it's also going to be able to do some streaming with PC games. It will stream to your PC.
Yeah, I was reading impressions of people playing Assassin's Creed in particular on it. And sort of running Assassin's Creed on their PC and then streaming it to the Shield. And that sounds really cool, except that I already have that functionality with my Wii U. And with the Shield, apparently, you'll only have support for that on certain high-end NVIDIA chipsets.
Right.
So I, for example, would have to buy, you know, a whole new card in my PC to take advantage of this. So I'm not really on board with the Shield yet. I think it's cool that they're trying to make this sort of all-in-one portable console, but I just sort of feel like, for the most part, everything it can do, I have other devices that can do better.
Yeah, I think my issue with it is that, like I briefly mentioned, it feels like it's trying to do too many things at once. You know, it's trying to be a portable, but also like a kind of a living room sort of thing. And, you know, I think my bigger concern, though, is that with the Ouya coming out, is that it's just going to continue to further cause further fragmentation in the Android marketplace. And I don't think that would be good for either the Ouya or the Shield or, you know, Android smartphones, if you want to consider those two. We're just going to have to kind of see how this develops. One thing that was kind of interesting to me that ties into the Steam Box sort of thing and Steam Big Picture Mode is that when they first were mentioning this, like when it first got revealed at CES, they were like, oh yeah, I can run Big Picture Mode. At first I kind of thought, oh, well, that kind of sucks for, you know, Steam Box and Steam because, you know, I thought it would be in competition. But then that great interview on The Verge, which we'll link to you on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
You know, it made it very clear that, and as we kind of seen develop with Valve working with different hardware, third-party hardware. So, you know, I'm seeing the Shield less as a competitor to the Steam box, basically. As we've seen, that Steam box is not going to be a platform-specific thing. It's more of an initiative for...
it's like a multi-platform platform.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, yeah, let's be real. Anyone who listens to the show or anyone who knows me probably can tell you, as long as they can launch the Shield at an affordable price point, I'll pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks cool.
I just have my concerns that it might just be redundant, because it's doing a ton of things. It's not really excelling at any of them.
Yeah,
I can do better
elsewhere.
If
it's a jack of all trades, master of none, then it kind of will maybe have a problem. And, you know, if you disagree with us, tweet at us, leave a comment on our Facebook. We'll give you those URLs at the end of the show, but we aren't quite on board yet.
We'll probably pick it up, but not on board yet.
Yeah.
LOL nerd life.
Last little piece of CES news. It's not really actually news, but how about that Qualcomm keynote? That was pretty fun. Obviously nothing to do with gaming, really, but we're going to link it to you on GameBuoy.org.
Yeah, it was painful to watch.
Excuse me? We're going to link it to you on GameBuoy.org?
GameBuoy.org.
If you remember,
rude jerk.
If you remember that terrible Sony keynote from E3 a couple years ago.
Giant enemy crabs.
See, I was hoping you'd be like, oh, which one? I've got to not be so harsh on Sony. But, you know, this makes Giant Enemy Crab and Ridge Racer.
God damn it. I was going to interrupt you with Ridge Racer once you started talking again. I hate you.
You don't really hate me.
No, I don't.
Yeah, but this makes that Sony keynote look like really professional.
Yeah,
this
no,
is just
true facts.
This is just, I felt secondhand embarrassment for the people involved.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable to watch.
Pretty much. So, yeah, please watch it after the show. With that, I think we can move on to our discussion of the week.
I think we can. So this week, we're going to be talking a little bit about the changing role of challenge in games, which, amusingly, I was sure I was going to stumble on phonetically, and I feel like I did pretty okay.
You did.
So you may be wondering why we're discussing this. And really, the answer, you know, is that this is sort of a topic of discussion that's sort of been boiling just under the surface for a little while now. And we now have a, you know, gigantic Game of the Year nominated game for 2012, having, you know, literally no a challenge present in the traditional sense of the
really
word.
Really, two Games of the Year, but one GameBuoy Game of the Year.
Well, yeah, I wasn't counting that. And also, Asura's Wrath has, you know, its challenging moments. But, you know, there were other notable games as well that had no fail condition present. And to me, this is sort of the perfect opportunity to take a look at challenging games. So I wanted to start off this discussion by bringing up the Nintendo Hard meme, which dictates that pretty much any and all games from the Nintendo era of gaming are so difficult that they're basically unbeatable at this point without help or a guide or what have you. I've never really been a big fan of this meme. I play a lot of NES games still. We've talked here as recently as last week about doing, you know, Mega Man 2 runs, even still pretty frequently. I don't think that these old NES games were really that hard, but I'd be interested in hearing what you think about that.
I mean, I think part of it for me has to do with growing up with the Nintendo. I mean, I was very young during the NES days, so I mean, any game that was, you know, more challenging than a 5 to 7 year old could play. I mean, I guess I can't really use that as a judge because you were not that much older than that, and you've always been pretty hardcore. But you know, coming to it from the perspective of a younger child, a lot of stuff was quote unquote too difficult for me. But I don't think that there are any games that I can think of that are so difficult as to the point where it's, you know, unplayable. because, you know, just so frustrating that, you know, basically that, you know, the difficulty getting in the way of the design of the game is what I'm trying to say here.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because the next sort of talking point I was going to bring to sort of touches on that, and I was going to ask how you felt about sort of fake difficulty in games. You know, games where sort of bad technical aspects interfere with actually playing the game, or, you know, like some of the old adventure games on PC, you know, the stuff that we now think of Tim Schafer as doing, where, you know, you could lose just by making a wrong choice with no indication. Like, oh, if you go through that door, you die. But there's no indication that that door will kill you. You open it, and then, oh, there's a tentacle monster, and you're eaten. How do you feel about that sort of thing?
You know, I think that the thing is that the world of gaming has really changed and evolved since the early days. I think developers are a lot more mindful of what they're putting out there. I think they're a lot more mindful of, you know, kind of the motivational, not like a motivational speech, motivational, but, you know, the motivation involved.
Incentives,
thank you. So, I mean, I guess there's a time and a place for super punishing difficulties, but...
Yeah, I enjoy those kinds of games, but I do recognize what you're saying.
I just think basically it's just that, you know, the kind of the whole gaming scene has really evolved since then, so...
Well, and let me ask you this. A lot of people think of challenge in games as directly relating, and obviously I have made comments myself today to sort of reflect this. A lot of people feel that challenge in games is directly reflected on how difficult it is to fall to the fail condition present in the game. You know, that is to indicate losing a life, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe flying your flower into an electrical pole and losing all of your little flower buds.
But you don't lose all of your flower buds. You're still just kind of upset about that, aren't you?
I thought that it was really inappropriate for them to introduce a fail condition after there
had
been
no fail
condition.
Well, that was
just
part of the emotional experience of the game. You're supposed to feel the shock of losing your flower petals.
Well, I was pretty mad.
Okay, then.
Okay, well, okay, flower made me feel things legitimately that I'm still mad feeling. Okay, whatever. How do you feel generally, in any event, about, you know, like a lives mechanic?
I mean, it's hard for me to say that it has no place in a certain type of game. Because, you know, I'm so used to games like Super Mario Brothers is obviously the first one that comes to mind. It's one of my formative gaming experiences. And, you know, Super Mario Brothers wasn't just super easy mode. You know, it was, you know, I would say it was pretty on par with platforming as far as, you know, difficulty goes back in the day. But, you know, so I guess it's hard for me to have an opinion that there's not a place for it. But like I said, there has to be a place for it. You know, just having that mechanic in there for the sake of being, oh, there's lives or no lives.
Well, it's interesting you said that. Let me compare and contrast two different games that use this mechanic completely differently. I'll pick two games that you know. So first off, New Super Mario Brothers U. You've played this, yes?
Of course, yes. I've talked about it on here on Game Buoy.
Exactly. So in that game, you get lives freely in abundance.
Yeah, you really do.
You occasionally might lose one or two, but you'll almost certainly get them back within moments. How do you feel that impacts that game's design as opposed to something like, let's say, Mega Man, where you have three lives to get through each, let's just say, for example, Fireman stage. And, oh, you just died on Fireman stage three times. You no longer get to start from the middle of it. You have to start from the beginning if you want to try again. how do you feel? Do you feel that either of those approaches feels more rewarding to you as a player to overcome?
No, I think they're actually equally rewarding because something like Mega Man, you know, if I die, and I talked about this last time, you know, it kind of encourages me to, you know, figure out what to do to get through. Something like New Super Mario Brothers U, you know, I don't want to say that it makes you feel like God mode or something, but, you know, when it does reward you openly and freely like that, oh, here's some more lives, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, it's motivating in its own way. And I do have to say that, you know, that also could open games like that up to adding more types of challenges in that you might have not seen on something like Super Mario Brothers 1. And, I mean, I would argue that there's a lot more platforming-wise going on. But, you know, I don't want to talk about just platform gaming.
Well, you know, and the reason I brought it up in that context, of course, is because for me personally, I look at the Mega Man games and I look at the way they leverage players' lives as, you know, attempts on that run through to succeed at your objective, you know, destroying X or Y Robot Master. And then I was playing New Super Mario Bros. U, and I felt like this entire mechanic was basically pointless because I ended up getting, you know, 900 or 99 lives or what, however many. I was at the max, and I would get more, and nothing would happen because I already had as many as you could have. It was just like, this whole mechanic, like, I'm actually irritated by all of these extra lives
floating
around.
Maybe in the case of the Mario platformers, like I said, there should be a time and a place where that mechanic's used. Maybe it's past the point where it's necessary. I mean, I guess it makes me feel safer having that buffer, so to say, you know, like that, not as stressed out if I make a stupid mistake, I guess.
Now, see, that's an interesting thought. And I hadn't considered that because, and I don't think I've really hidden this fact. I find most of these new Mario games to be super, super easy. So I guess I hadn't really considered that. Maybe some people do need that many chances.
Right. I mean, especially, I think another thing to look at is audience. You know, I would argue that definitely even more so than before. I mean, because I feel like the Nintendo Entertainment System, the Famicom, family computer, it was always meant to be a family thing. So, you know.
Yeah.
That said, I think there's definitely, and I don't want to bring back the meme that, oh, you know, Nintendo is for babies, but, you know, Nintendo specifically, like, the Mario games, I think they do want to be rewarding for a wide range of audience.
Well, excellent.
Mega Man set out to be a little more of a hardcore thing, so, you know.
Well, you just gave me the perfect segue to talk about Here and Now. Do games need to be hard to compete in this current era of gaming? And I mean this, of course, in both in terms of mind share / critical opinion, as well as sales.
I mean, what I would almost argue is that there are definitely people like you, and I'm not throwing shade at
no,
you.
No, that's perfectly fine.
There are people like you who thrive on, like, really, really tough challenge. I just have to say, you know, we'll be touching on this a little bit later, but, you know, the whole idea of difficulty levels in games, I tend to go on a normal. Captain Spike is probably one who would be like, oh, I guess I'll go through on hard, but only because I want to unlock very hard. But, you know, I would almost argue that in terms of a wider audience, that punishingly difficult games almost turn off people from wanting to play them. I mean, that might be my bias, but I mean, I just compared to then when that was sort of the norm.
I see. Now, see, that's an interesting thought. And, you know, I do find myself biased in this, in the opposite direction of you. Because when I hear a game is easy, that's a huge turnoff for me. Like, if someone says, oh, that game is really easy, that's like, I would rather play a game that someone said, oh, I hated it. But if someone's like, oh, I loved it, but it's easy, I'd be, for me, that's like, okay, I would probably be better served ignoring that game completely. So, in fact, that is what happened with Flower for a long time. Certainly, I was incorrect, ultimately, that Flower is a great game. But when I was being told, oh, yeah, there's no fail condition, you just float around, you collect stuff, I was like, I'm out. That sounds like the most awful thing in the entire world, and I want nothing to do with it.
Well, I mean, and I think part of it might just be the type of game you were raised on. You expecting, and I'm not saying that you're closed off to these other ideas, but just growing up with things like Mega Man and things with, you know, perhaps punishing grinds RPG-wise, you know, I think maybe you had grown accustomed to the idea of a video game, expecting a video game to provide a challenge, and the more challenging the challenge, let us say, the better. Where I guess what we're starting to see more now is, you know, focus on story, focus on storytelling rather, and experiences and emotions, I guess, which you know, which isn't to say that that's not that's in lieu of difficulty, but.
Although I will say it currently feels that it is in lieu of difficulty, I don't think it has to be that way.
Well, I mean, take a game like Bayonetta. If you're playing Bayonetta, you know, there's not a lives mechanic. You just start back from your last save point. And, I mean, I think that is also kind of an interesting topic in itself, you know, kind of the advent of save points. But I mean, there's always been, the thing is to say that that's just a modern innovation or whatever is kind of to diminish the presence of like the password dot system in Mega Man that we talked about last time. Yeah, I mean,
you can take it way further back than that. If you're talking about passwords, you could look at, you know, Metroid is a good example.
Exactly,
Kid
yeah.
Kid Icarus, which, you know.
Yeah, both of them, you know, before we started seeing more of saves. And, I mean, it's something else I kind of think of is, you know, there were a couple times when I was playing things like, you know, Assassin's Creed, like any of the games in the series. It's like, oh, you know, I just totally fucked up, but it's just going to let me start from the last autosave. The thing is that I kind of realized when I was thinking about that in, like, the evolution of challenging gaming, because basically it's just saying, no, you fucked up, you can fuck up again, but basically you have to get through this in order to be moving on with the story. And I guess what I realized is that that's not really a recent development. I mean, if you think of something like The Legend of Zelda, I'm not saying that it forced story on you. I'd argue otherwise, that you were free to do things in the order you wanted as long as you, you know, were up for the challenge. But in that respect, the only thing that really you would have gotten from not dying, you know, is kind of just bragging rights. And I mean, I guess that kind of leads to, you know, the purpose of lives and getting through to the end of the game and all that anyway. But I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is that even something like The Legend of Zelda still gave you as many chances as you needed to get through the game. And so I think people feel that a lot has changed, but I don't think that everything is, like, radically different. I do think that, of course, we're seeing a lot more things like The Walking Dead and Journey that are basically just totally focused on story, you know, and emotions and storytelling. But I don't know. I just, I think that really, yes, we are seeing a lot more reliance on, oh, well, you can just pick up on your last save. And it's really, I mean, I'm trying to think of modern examples where it's like, okay, you have three lives, and if you lose them, game over, you know? Because we've gotten to a point where everything's has, like, game saves, everything has checkpoints, to the point, like, where, you know, it's kind of like, so, I mean, maybe it has gotten a little bit more reliant on that. Even if you think of something like first-person shooters, it's like, oh, you're just going to respawn anyway, so I don't know. It's kind of, it has changed, but it hasn't, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well said-ish.
Rude.
I know, right? Ish. I found myself agreeing with a great deal of what you were saying. So, I guess ultimately then you're saying that you don't feel like games need to be hard to compete in this current era.
Well, I mean, look at Journey. It sold extremely well. It's very critically acclaimed. I mean, I think it just depends on what kind
of... And certainly Walking Dead falls under both of those.
Right, which I haven't spent much time with yet, but yeah. I mean, I guess one way to look at it is what type of game is it trying to be? If you think of something like Ninja Gaiden 3, which came out in its original form, it was laughed at because Ninja Gaiden games aren't supposed to be like watered down like that, to the point where Razor's Edge for Wii U brought back that difficulty level, that, you know, that increased difficulty. And I mean, I guess you've even seen it with the Sigma releases for the other ones, but... So, I mean, I think part of it really is just dependent on what type of game and the goal and the design of the game, really.
Excellent. I think that's a really good point. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, I hate throwing shade at this game, but the upcoming DMC Devil May Cry looks to be a lot easier than the previous games in the Devil May Cry series. So I guess, to some degree, that'll be a really good case study for sort of the intersection of changing the level of challenge in a popular series and seeing how the fan base reacts to that.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be a good litmus test for this question. We've seen a bad example of that with Ninja Gaiden 3. That game got shat on, in the words of Kotaku.
Oh, man. Dung sandwich. All right, let's wrap this discussion up. Just as a real quick little fun facts, we wanted to real quick go over five games that you have probably played as a Game Buoy listener that were changed in the exportation from Japan to America, or vice versa in one instance, notably in terms of difficulty. The easiest one to talk about, because it's a fairly minor change, was in the aforementioned in this episode, Black Tiger. The Japanese version was called Black Dragon, and it had, you know, like more enemy spawns with attacks that did way more damage. The bosses were hella more aggressive, and there were tons more falling rock traps. To say nothing, of course, about how much more expensive the items were to purchase with the in-game money.
Huh, interesting.
The funny thing about that is, you know, one of the arcades I used to frequent had one of those MAME machines that was like 4,000 arcade games in one. And there was Black Tiger in there, and the ROM or whatever must have been the Japanese version, because it was so effing hard.
And you're like, wait, this isn't how this game plays.
Yeah, well, exactly. Falling rock traps would fall on me, and I'd be like, there's not supposed to be that there. Is this a hack? Or, like, a boss would attack me, and I'm standing in the zone that I thought was the safe area, like in the US version, and then, oh, no, wait, this boss totally just jumped over me and killed me. Crap.
And then you probably went back to that arcade because you're like, this game's harder. That's awesome.
No, I mean, I certainly, it did feel like a letdown to go back to the US version after playing that one a while.
That's interesting.
But it was neat.
And it's kind of funny that we think of, oh, well, Japanese games are more hardcore and they dumb it down for Americans, because what about our next example, Captain Spike?
Well, in Battletoads, the Japanese version is a bit easier than the Western release. It's still super hard because
Battletoads was a fucking hard game.
Yeah, it was super hard. But the level 3, the infamous speeder level, has tons of extra jump ramps, and they removed all of those mid-air jump ramps that you had to totally jump, like, at the exact right timing in order to hit. I never really thought that that speeder bike level was super hard.
I did.
I mean, I can still single-play play through it pretty easily. That level, not the whole game.
Prove it. I was going to be like, prove it. Right now.
Girl, we got plans tonight. And also, the speeder bike level, it doesn't speed up toward the end, which to me would be unpleasant. I like how it gets super fast at the end, and so the last obstacles you have to dodge are, like, super, super strict on timing. I love it. And the hypno orb in the toward the end of the game also actually moves slower so that you can deal with that easier. And the players also have five lives per continue instead of three, which is obviously a pretty big deal in a game like
that. Yeah, that's like, that definitely gives you some extra room to make mistakes, especially in a game like Battletoads. Shit.
Yeah, it gives you a buffer, so to speak, I think, as you called it earlier.
Yes, yes.
Next up, Castlevania III, Dracula's Curse. This is actually a really, really weird, because it's not strictly easier or harder. It's just like a complete retool of how the difficulty system of the game works.
Huh.
In the Western version, every enemy takes off the same amount of damage, and then in later areas of the game, they all do increased damage. But, like, early in the game, if you get hit by an enemy, it's going to be, like, one or two squares of damage. And then later in the game, it's, you know, three or four. And then toward the end, oh, five or six. In the Japanese version, every enemy does their own independent level of damage. And that damage that they inflict remains the same throughout the entire rest of the game. So, like, oh, this little bat's only ever going to ding me for one. But this Axe Knight is going to ding me for three or four every time I see it.
Huh, that's interesting.
So, I mean, I assume that would just change the entire way the difficulty works.
Both seem valid, but, I mean, that would definitely change your experience playing it, for sure. Huh.
The Western room also has more enemies in some rooms, and Grant Dynasty, the really cool pirate whom we love here at Game Buoy, in Japan, had throwing daggers, which was really cool because you could attack ranged things. Like, it made Grant super good. Like, he could climb on walls, he was super agile, he could, you know, throw his knives. But in the U.S., he just has a little stabby dagger with an awful attack range.
Wah, wah.
The funny thing is, even as a kid, I noticed, like, this seems broken. Like, his little dagger has no range and does no damage. Like, shouldn't it be the opposite? If I have to put myself in danger to hit with this, shouldn't it be doing more damage? And this is the reason why. His dagger was supposed to be thrown and go hella far away and be useful for that. So that's... I've always found that really interesting since discovering that a few years back. It was just... sort of blew my mind. All of the Castlevania games are sort of different in Japan.
And it's interesting because it seems like neither one has, like, the best. It sounds like some things were good about one and some were good about the other, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Depending definitely. On what you're looking for, I guess.
Well, as you were saying in your gigantic essay-length talking point previously, which, by the way, is not shade. I loved it. You know, different people are looking for different things, so some people probably prefer one and some prefer the other.
Cool.
Devil May Cry 3. This is noteworthy because it was made way harder for the U.S. All of the difficulties for the U.S. release were, like, bumped up one from the Japanese release. So what in the U.S. version was normal, in Japan was hard. What was easy in the U.S. was, like, Japanese normal. So, interestingly, this is a game that was fairly difficult, even in its original release, even on easy. Like, it's a hard game. As a somewhat interesting aside, a lot of magazine reviews and internet reviews pegged this game as being much even harder than it originally was, due to a bug in the review code that made all of Dante's attacks do way less damage to the bosses in the first and second levels.
Oh, interesting.
Obviously, that has no real merit in this discussion, but it's just a fun aside. The special edition re-release restored all of the original difficulties, with the special American hard mode becoming very hard in that game.
Hmm.
And last, but certainly not least, we have Streets of Rage 3.
Urgh.
The difficulty levels were adjusted between release. So the Japanese version had, you know, easy, normal, hard, and very hard. And the American version removed very hard, but buffed the other difficulties up by one.
So they almost did a Devil May Cry then.
It's actually somewhat similar, yeah. Except instead of Devil May Cry adding a new hard mode, this one uses the old version's hard mode, but erases the easy mode.
Huh. So, I mean, it's just really interesting that the meme is typically, oh, Japanese games are more hardcore, but that's really not true. In fact, that we're seeing with some of these games that they actually bumped it up for American release, so very interesting.
And, you know, to add insult to injury, easy mode on the American version, despite in Japan being the normal version, wouldn't let you play past level 5.
Oh.
After which you'd get, like, a bad ending and encouragement to play the game not on easy.
Sorry, bro.
You know, funny enough, the Japanese version, which had its own easy that was way easier and not present in the American version, still let you play all the way through the game even on easy mode. So they basically were just like, fuck you, America.
Rude.
Yeah, I know, right? Interestingly, there's a couple of games I can think of where in easy mode you could not finish the game. The one that really comes to mind is Contra 3, The Alien Wars for Super Nintendo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, that used to piss me off. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Although now that I think about it, I should have prepared content for a discussion about that.
Oh, well.
You live, you learn, you get loves. Anyway, to wrap this up, we're going to post on our website, GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Some further reading on this information. I know we have quite a few listeners who are involved in game design, game development in various levels. I just think there's some really fascinating resources out there for how you can apply difficulty to your game balance and sort of make a better experience.
Definitely. We won't spend too much time going over these because you can read them from the links we provide on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
But there was a great one that we found on Gamasutra. It includes some case studies such as God Hand, which of course was a Clover gem. Another one from The Escapist, which is just a little column really on difficulty levels. It even I believe mentions Devil May Cry, I believe, but also things like Mario Galaxy. And then Captain Spike, you even had something different, not quite a thing that we can link, right?
Well, there's a book written by David Searlin. You might be familiar with him from his time on the competitive Street Fighter scene. He later went on to work with Capcom rebalancing Super Street Fighter II Turbo HD Remix. Oh my gosh, I said that without stumbling. So David Searlin wrote a book called Playing to Win. It basically changed my life forever in terms of how I play competitive games. I believe he has the entire book up on his website, but I'm not sure. But in any event, if you're interested in sort of how to view difficulty and competitiveness as a player of games, especially fighting games, I definitely recommend the book Playing to Win.
Excellent. That sounds like a good read. And speaking of a good read, I think it's time.
I'm sorry, excuse me? You just skipped something that I had to say.
You know, I was just so focused on that being, like, the best transition ever that I did almost skip a segment that we've kind of pushed off to the side or has been absorbed by other segments lately. So, let's go ahead and talk about...
I said, hey, what's going on?
I'm sorry about that. I guess to make it easier, at least we're kind of talking about the same games this week.
Yeah, yeah. So this week, I've been playing, you know, Anarchy Reigns came out. And...
Yeah, we also tweeted about it and stuff, so please go pick it up.
Oh, yeah. I think most of the people that listen to our show probably also follow us on Twitter and or Facebook.
True.
I hope. So hopefully you already know Anarchy Reigns is out in stores now. Hopefully y'all bought it. Hopefully even more of you pre-ordered it so that you could get the Bayonetta exclusive DLC. Basically, I like the game a lot. I'm very happy with it. I think Deathball is amazing, and I would totally buy...
Deathball was the best.
I would buy a standalone Deathball game. I'll tell you that. I will tell you that. But also, I have returned to the World of Warcraft.
Same here.
I have been playing, like, 20-plus hours a week.
And why don't you tell our listeners what you've been working on?
I rolled a Blood Elf Monk on the Proudmoor server.
The Homo server.
Yeah, Homo
Planet. Why don't you go on the Homo Planet?
LOL, right? I'm on it. It's called Earth. Thanks, bro. So, I'm having a lot of fun. I think I rolled in like 7 days ago now. Maybe eight. I've gotten to Outland, and I'm working on... You know, getting him up to endgame.
That's cool. I've been working on an undead warlock that had started about a year or so back, maybe even longer at this point. And it's been cool just kind of doing something different. I've been more of an alliance person in my time, so it's kind of cool to see how the other side lives. Just to go back to Anarchy Reigns really quickly, I just have to say that the dogfight mode... which is what we had been talking about with the pre-order bonus. Dogfight mode was actually really terrible, so...
Yeah, dogfight mode is awful.
If you didn't pick up Anarchy Reigns at GameStop, it does suck that you're missing out on Bayonetta, but dogfight mode was not so great.
Not so great at all.
So, yeah, having a lot of fun with both of those games. And having a lot of fun with both of those games with Captain Spike. We've been playing together, so...
Woot, woot!
Anything else to say about either of those games, Captain Spike?
No, I think we can get on to your reading.
Well, to your reading. And you and Radioland should be reading along, because...
Let's get on to those fundamentals.
What time is it?
Welcome to our Read of the Week.
Ooh, the shade of it all.
This week, we are neither reading nor are we reading. Instead, we are going to let Forbes.com read Kotaku.
This gave me life.
Oh, I bet it did. This is exactly the type of problem we're continually trying to emphasize here on Game Buoy. You know, it's unfortunate because there's this Kotaku article, and it was ostensibly about how Hideki Kamiya-san, obviously one of my favorite figures in gaming, is, you know, he's of a very Japanese mindset. He doesn't really get, you know, Valve and PC gaming, because those things are just not super important in the games industry in Japan. And unfortunately, Kotaku wrote this article that was not even awful. The article itself is actually it's reasonably fair-handed and tries to point out, while here in the US, you know, every game developer knows what PC gaming is and knows who Valve is, that in Japan it's just like, whatever, I don't know what that is, LOL, bye. But the headline they went with was, "The guy who made Bayonetta is clueless about Valve and PC gaming."
Mm-mm. Oh, and, no, you didn't.
And that's awful. Like, that is insulting. It is inflammatory. It's just the worst kind of sensationalist headline. And Forbes, one of the writers over at Forbes, the writer over at Forbes, wrote an article called Kotaku and the Problem with Anti-Inflammatory Headlines in Video Game Blogging.
Inflammatory, my friend.
What did I say?
You said anti-inflammatory. Ah! I think you were thinking of something like anti-inflammatory medicine.
Well, I just took some Advil for a headache, so give me a little bit of slack.
Now, I think you were skipping one important point, though.
Was I?
Did you mention that Kamiya-san tweeted back when someone mentioned this to him on Twitter? One of his followers said, "Hey, Kotaku wrote an article about you," and I just love how bitchy that some of these heroes of ours in the Japanese gaming industry can be. Basically, this person was like, "Hey, Kamiya-san, Kotaku wrote an article about you and your attitudes about PC gaming because of your tweets." And he retweeted that and he said, "Ah, douchebags." And, you know, what he was saying, basically, and what this wonderful article on Forbes.com, which, I mean, Forbes, way to go lately. Forbes.com has been putting out some great gaming content. Is basically that this is a problem, and this is like the ultimate read. Because this read is about a read. And, I mean, this is exactly the type of thing we've been trying to address, like Captain Spike said. You know, the thing is that even if you have valid points to make, these inflammatory, sensationalist headlines are
rude.
Are just, I was not trying to point out your mistake. I was just trying to say that, yes, they are inflammatory headlines. They're sensationalist. They're focused on getting page hits. And Forbes calls them out on that. Forbes.com.
Forbes.com.
This is by Eric Kane, is a contributor over at Forbes.com. So good on him for saying what we've been trying to say here since the beginning of our show with our little Taku of the Week and now our Read of the Week. You know, when things are like, why Xenoblade Chronicles makes me want to punch a kitten? Who's going to take that seriously? And like I said, Chris Clue, great guy, but I do have to disagree with him on that article. And I think that this Kotaku is definitely the worst with this. And, you know, they deserve to be called out. We expect better because these people are our eyes and ears to the industry. And when it makes a pretty strong case because a site like Forbes.com is calling out a gaming site and, you know, also consistently putting out higher quality gaming articles than one of our web's most visited gaming sites. So, thank you for that read, Forbes. This is a definite read.
Yeah, this read is a read. So,
this read is a read.
And, you know, as always, we're not doing this to be unpleasant Paulas, but, you know, we all just deserve better, especially from, you know, Kotaku and Joystick and, you know, all of these pages that are getting, you know, so many hits every day. Like, y'all can afford to report decently. You don't have to be awful in the ways that finally now people are sort of starting to take up and take notice.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously this is a problem in the wide, like, this is a widespread problem, not just in gaming journalism, but, you know, we expect better. So, with that, I guess we have a listener feedback before we can wrap this up, right?
Tweedly, tweedly, tweet.
Our friend Dan Diaz over on Twitter was listening to our Mega Man episode. He said, "What about Mega Man Soccer?" And he said that Street Fighter Cross Mega Man is downloaded. He's going to tweet us again when he's played it. So thanks for your tweet, Dan. We're looking forward to hearing about what you have to say about Street Fighter Cross Mega Man. Do you have anything to say about Mega Man Soccer?
As a matter of fact, I do. I feel like we did mention it, but not by name. Something very interesting about Mega Man Soccer is that it was inadvertently released in an incomplete state.
That's right.
I thought that we had glanced over that, but you're right, we didn't drop Mega Man Soccer by name. So let me just say, Mega Man Soccer is my very favorite Mega Man game to play. Blah, 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 blah. No, it is not my favorite Mega Man game to play. But it is my favorite soccer game to play.
Is it now?
Oh, yeah, quite. And, you
Even
know,
more than something like Super Mario Strikers, huh?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, I didn't really care for Strikers.
Huh, okay.
But Mega Man Soccer, huge fan, love the way they worked all of the Mega Man powers into it. I love, if you can get the Dr. Wily to be playable.
Dr. Wily.
unfortunately, I've only ever seen it happen once while the game was, like, bugging out with glitches and the game crashed mid-match. But, that's a real thing that can happen. He was present in the game and was supposed to be in the game. But again, much like the endings in the game, which are also there, as well as the credits with credit music, you can only access it either through glitching the game out or via Game Genie.
Oh, so speaking of fake difficulty, huh?
Oh, yeah, right? Otherwise, when you win at the end of the game, it just kicks you right back to the start screen as if nothing happened.
I wonder if Professor Candy was in there messing with the code, Sugar Rush style.
Yeah, I'm not really here for Wreck-It Ralph references right now.
Ugh, rude. Anyway, thanks for your
thanks for your feedback,
tweet.
Dan.
And,
it was an oversight. There is no hate against Mega Man Soccer. We have nothing but love for
sports and Mega Man
for the Blue
Who knew?
Bombers balls.
Whoa, now.
I'm eager to hear what you thought about Street Fighter Cross Mega Man. Please hit us up and let us know when you're done with it. And with that,
where can they hit us up, Captain Spike?
Well, you know, it's funny that you should ask, because I was just going to implore all of our lovely listeners of Radioland to subscribe to us via iTunes. Leave us ratings and reviews on same. Please.
Preferably 5 stars. We'll love you.
You know, but if you think we only deserve one, I'm okay with that.
I'm going to cry myself to sleep.
You would. Like us on Facebook.
Facebook.com/GameBooey.
Facebook.com/GameBooey. And most of all, we fucking love Twitter,
we
so
fucking
tweet
love
at
Twitter.
Us.
Tweet at us.
At GameBooey.org, DOTORG.
At GameBooey.org, spelled DOTORG.
And of course, for my shout-outs, if you like what we do but want it gayer and more Nintendo-oriented, check out Koopa Club. They're great and we love what they do. Of course, Orange Lounge Radio, OLR, where every gamer has a voice.
Every
and from
gamer
whom
has a voice.
We take... Oh, so many of our cues.
Very blatantly, I might add. Got a shout-out to my bros at Nerdgasm Network, the wildest, often 3 hours of shock jock video game radio realness that you'll ever come across. Always a good time listening and guessing on that show. The best little horde house in Azeroth is the place of World of Warcraft news, but never too seriously. And Girls Gone Wow, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. I have to credit both of them for getting me kind of interested in jumping back into the game. And last but certainly not least, Video Game Outsiders, which is an Xbox Live Community Award-winning podcast. It's running over 7 years strong at this point, and, you know, we just love what they're putting out there. Also, thanks to Zelda Reorchestrated for our awesome opening theme music. Go check them out if you're a fan of Zelda music or video game music in general. And with that...
as always, folks, thank you for listening. We love you. Stay thinking, stay gaming, stay cool, and see you, Space Cowboy. Thank you. Ooh, girl,